I want to go to Hebrews 9 to start the sermon today. You know, it is a beautiful day out here, isn't it? I mean, it almost makes you feel like you really are glad you're alive. Today, I want to remind you, you're going to die. Today, baby boomers are poised to start handing over their estates to their children. And being written into a will can be a really wonderful surprise, but it can also sometimes turn into a nightmare. You know, some people call it luck, and others say, well, it depends on the family you're born into, and that's all. But today, some children, some kids are poised to receive inheritances that are more money than you and I would ever even dream of. Baby boomer money. Delphine Arnault is the daughter of the head of LVMH Group. Their clients include Louis Vuitton, Moet & Hennessy. They sell Dior watches and just about anything else having to do with luxury. And this lady is poised to become one of the richest women in the world when the head of that corporation passes away. Sam Branson's father, Richard, is currently worth $3.8 billion, and his son is going to inherit Virgin Records, Virgin Books, Virgin Atlantic Airways, Virgin Mobile, and Virgin Fuel. Imagine that. What an inheritance that is. Charlene Heineken became the wealthiest woman in the Netherlands. Her father, Alfred Heineken, passed away in 2003, and she became heiress to this premium beer and to the company that makes it. She's now worth $7 billion. IKEA, best known for its extremely affordable home furnishings, it's Ingvar Kamprad, who's the head of this corporation, but he has three sons, and they are poised today to inherit $33 billion. What's often amazing is that sometimes people are never satisfied with what they're going to inherit. People will fight over an inheritance to get all they can, and brothers and sisters will squabble and fight, and husbands and wives will break up. All kinds of relationships will be erased like they never existed as people fight over their inheritance. They want to get all they can. And the lawyers, man, they absolutely love this. Perhaps one of the most famous cases was Marshall versus Marshall. It involved over more than a decade of litigation, and it still, to this day, remains unresolved. J. Howard Marshall had formulated what he believed to be the best possible crafting of an estate when he died. Anna Nicole Smith married him and lived with him 14 months. Before he died, and she was intentionally left out of his written will. But she claimed that unknown to anybody else, he had told her that he was going to give her half of that money. So there was a probate trial in Texas over this issue, and the probate court in Texas threw it out. They ruled against her. But her legal team proved pretty tenacious, so just before the verdict of the Texas court, she moved it to California and saying someone had sued her for bankruptcy, so she took it to a bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy court ruled their biggest win, actually, for that team. She got about $500 million, they ruled. So they had convinced the judge of the bankruptcy court that it did not have to be held in Texas. So they reversed that. And then it went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Thereat, a Nichols legal team lost on every single count. The court ruled the law required it to be held in Texas. Then the appeal went to the Supreme Court, and the legal team there won a big victory. And in 2006, the opinion of the Supreme Court was that the other courts had been wrong, and that she did have a right to appeal to get this money. And so the litigation continued on until she died. But now it still continues on. Because after she died, then others began to fight over who it was that was the real father of her child, because the child would inherit any money that they got from her ex-husband's estate. And so today, it still goes on, fighting and arguing over this issue of the estate of her ex-husband. What was really interesting to me as I researched this was there was a reporter that did an interview with Anna Nicole before she died. And he said that he was made to wait for some time in the lobby for her to come out, but he said, you know, he saw her there with her hair in curlers and no makeup, and he said she looked strikingly ordinary in that situation. But she, after a half an hour, she came out kind of leaning on Howard Stern's arm, and she said, I'm hungry. And so they got some spinach sauce delivered to her, and then Howard Stern took the spinach out of her teeth before the interview, and finally he got the interview. But he was told she cannot talk about the lawsuit over her ex-husband's will. She cannot talk about the drugs or the alcohol or her dead son. So the reporter said, I kind of wondered, well, what is there to talk about, you know? But then he asked her a question. He said to her, tell me what was your happiest moment. And he said she looked really sad as she looked down at the floor, and she said, I really can't think of one. I can't think of one. And he said, well, all right then, well, tell me what was your saddest experience in life. And he said at that, she just broke down and began uncontrollable sobbing over and over again, just tears flowing. And she said, I guess some of the happiest times were when I was a young girl and I worked at a restaurant. I really enjoyed mopping the floors. I really enjoyed talking with my girlfriends. And I remember getting paid Friday, and I'd take my money and I go down to Walmart and I buy a trinket or I buy something nice for the house. And she said, those are the only things I remember. It's interesting, isn't it? With all the money and all the fame and all the status, the things we do every day were her high points in her life. So there's probably a lesson in that. We should probably appreciate the life that we have. So now, people are fighting for her money, all they can get from her ex-husband's estate. And people everywhere, I think, fight over money, it seems. I mean, you see a divorce and it's a battle over the money. You see a death and there's a battle over the inheritance. And I remember one lady and her brother. And I remember this clearly, that the brother had received more of the inheritance. He got all the investments, all the money in the bank, and he got all the cars. And then the sister got the house and the furnishings in it. And after the funeral, on the way back home, she came in to the house that she had inherited. And there was her brother, who had gotten a key, and his wife were in there unloading as much stuff as they could. And then there were twin sisters. And there was an inheritance of over $300,000. And they fought, and they fought over $2,000, and they never speak to one another and never did until the one died. Money can do amazing things. Now my question today is this. Let's read Hebrews 9 as a reminder and consider some things today. It is appointed unto men once to die, and then after this, there is a judgment. And so in that context, I ask us today to think about, what are you going to leave those who are still alive when you die? Genesis 49. What are we going to leave our children and our loved ones when we pass away? Is it going to be money that they might fight over? There is a certain Dr. Hurluck, and he was quoted to say this, when does a man die? Is it when he's hit with a bullet? No, I don't think so, he says. Is it when he suffers from some terrible disease? Again, he says, I don't think so. Is it when he eats some soup made with some kind of poison in it and he passes away from that? Is that when a man dies? And he says, no, again. And here's what he does say. A man or a woman dies when they are forgotten. What an interesting point. It is an interesting point. There's an element of truth in that statement. You see, the relatives can fight over the money, and the money's going to be the first thing that disappears, isn't it? But the legacy of a person's life is going to go on much longer. And it's this I want us to think about today. It's possible to leave something of real and lasting value, and it is possible to leave something that your relatives won't be fighting and arguing over. Yes, a resounding yes to this. Today, there are people who are in the business of writing wills. They're professionals, but they are writing a different kind of will, and it's called an ethical will. Have you ever heard of that? Yes, writing an ethical will. It's not a legally binding document. It's not designed for publication to others. But the writer tries in this will to pass on their values, not their valuables. And they want to pass these on. And those who do this say it began long ago with the Bible writers who wanted to pass on their experiences, and they wanted their posterity to learn what they had learned. And for instance, in Genesis 49, here Jacob gathers his family all together before he dies, and he gives his family prophecies of what their future is going to hold. And in verse 1, he says, Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last day. And you remember the account of Moses? Didn't he do something similar? He gathered all of Israel before he knew he was going to die, didn't he? And he gathered all Israel to him, and then he gave them a recounting of all that they had experienced from the time they left Egypt and how God had called them out and how they had sinned. And then he gave them advice how to be successful, when they went into the new land. The father of the Rechabites, as you remember, had given them some advice. Don't ever drink wine. And for centuries they followed that advice their father gave them before he died. And God said, as a result of that, following that advice, I'm going to make sure your seed will always exist down through time. That is a legacy that is going to last forever. That is a legacy that counts so much more than money. Since that time, the Jewish people have written these ethical wills to their children for centuries. The earliest of such is still in existence. It's from Eleazar, who wrote to his son Isaac of Worms in 1050, and they have this record, where he wrote, "Think not evil, for evil thinking leads to evil doing. Purify your body, the dwelling place of your spirit, and give all your food, give of your food a portion to God. And let God's portion be the best, and give it to the poor." How interesting. The will of Judah ben Saul in 1190 states this: "Avoid bad society. Make your books your companions. Let your bookcases and shelves be the gardens and pleasure grounds of your life. Pluck the fruit that grows therein and gather the roses and spices and myrrh. If your soul be satiate and weary, change from garden to garden and furrow to furrow, from site to site. Then your desire will renew itself and your soul will be satisfied with delight." Now, there is the advice of a scholarly family. Another one, Yechiel, wrote in the 14th century, calling his will by a title. He called it Ways of Life, and he put 132 maxims in this ethical will. And of those maxims, many are now written in prayer books that the Jewish people use. But he said, "Do not obey the law for reward." He's telling his children, don't do this. Don't obey God's law for reward, nor avoid sin for fear of punishment. But serve God from love. Sleep not overmuch, but rise with the birds, and be not over hasty to reply to offensive remarks. Raise not your hand against another, even if he curses your father or mother in your presence. You know, don't look for trouble. Don't push the buttons and hurt yourself. But you understand that an ethical will like this that lasts down for centuries, we're reading the ethical wills written by people who lived centuries ago. Pieces of that they wrote to their children. It can become one of the most cherished and meaningful gifts a person can leave. It's like a love letter to your family. And today they're hiring professionals to help them write these things down. And so people will talk to their children about forgiveness for things they may not have done that they think they should have done. They'll write about various turning points in their lives and what brought that about. And they'll talk about lessons that they have learned. They'll recount how they applied principles to tough times in life, and they will relate the transitions that took place in their lives. They'll write about challenging situations and how they dealt with them. And they'll tell their children what they're really grateful for. And they'll tell them the regrets they have for the things they didn't do. And perhaps most important, they'll tell them how much I really loved you. Maybe I didn't show it enough, but I want you to know, now that I'm gone, I want you to make sure and know how much I loved you. These are pretty important things that are worth so much more than money. Karen Russell was a lady whose husband was Michael Press, her first husband, and he often would write her notes, and he'd put them in her shoes, and she'd go, "What's this?" and pull out it, and there'd be a note to her, you know. She'd find notes, she'd pour cereal into the bowl, and there'd be a note there to her, you know. And she said once she picked up the toilet seat, and there was an irreverent poem written to her, probably about putting the seat down or something. But anyway, Press died at age 29 from a car crash in which he was struck by a drunk driver. And later on, his wife was cleaning the bathroom, and she picked up the Kleenex box, and there under the Kleenex box was a note from her deceased husband. And it said this: "You, Karen, are a special jewel in the universe." And he wrote this missive expecting her to live out her dreams and accomplish all she desired. And the note that he planted under this box became something even more important than that. It turned out to be his last will and testament to her. He ended the note saying this: "Never doubt yourself, for you possess marvelous talents." Later, she said that his note was an enormous connection back to him. This last communication from him actually changed her life because it changed the direction. It was so powerful, and she thought, if only I could have the power to affect people and comfort them in the way like he has done. And so she formed a nonprofit corporation eventually that is the National Grief Support Service. Without knowing, her husband had written an ethical will, and that ethical will changed her life. It changed her career. And so now people are picking up on this, and they're writing ethical wills to their children. And there is a place, I believe, for such a thing in our lives because of this. Every generation passes down the technical knowledge that we have achieved in this life. We give to the next generation. And yet the next generation grows in every generation to have greater and greater knowledge. And so today we have enough knowledge to kill ourselves hundreds of times over from the technology we pass down. But how to use that technology and how to live with one another is something each one of us has to learn individually over a lifetime, how to live. Mr. Armstrong said, people say experience is the best teacher. But then he said it's not true. He said if we can live based on the lessons from the other people's lives, and if we can live by the lives that were lived and recorded in this book, and if we can learn from their experiences, that is the best teacher. And so it is that we want to think about this today. Let's go to Titus 2. Titus 2. God expects us to give that kind of information to our children and our loved ones. He gives us, it's interesting how he gives us enormous strength and vitality during our reproductive years. We have our children, and then he continues to give us strength so that we have the ability to raise them. But then as we get older, we lose that strength. And the society thinks of us as no longer having much worth. And when we think of the elderly almost in our culture and our society today, the elderly are like a throwaway, castaways, because they don't produce a lot of money. They're not bringing a lot to the society. And yet the elderly hold within their minds and their lives the experiences that can be passed on to others, and they can benefit in so many ways. So that not just they make money, but they know how to live their lives and they know what's really important. And so in that context, you know, there's so many more elderly people in our world today than ever before. But the Apostle Paul told Titus here, writes in this book, in chapter 2 and in verse 2. He said, well, starting in verse 1. "But speak to the things which become sound doctrine. That the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith and charity, and in patience. That the aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. Well, why? Why is it so important that he picks out the aged people and tells them to live this life of a good example? Well, the reason is this. It's for the purpose of helping those who are younger. In verse 4, he says, why? That they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, and to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. And so today we have so many more elderly people than we've ever had in the history of our country, and yet we have no social connectedness with them, it seems. We don't spend our time interacting much with the elderly. The advertising industry saw a source of more wealth. They could put a division between the young people and the older people. They could create a generation gap and make a whole new market in which they could sell their goods. And now our people are separated from their children by the clothes they wear, by the music they listen to, and by the movies they go watch. They could separate them, and now we have two markets instead of just one, you see. We're not learning as a result from one another's experiences. Aw, Dad, it's the 90s. Well, now it's the 2000s, you know. Things are different now, so nobody's listening. You understand my point. And so the conversation today is about TV programs and generally about gossip. It's not personal experiences and how to be better human beings. It's not that that we talk about. Oh yes, we're all plugged in today, aren't we? We're all plugged in. We're not plugged into one another. We're plugged into TV. We're plugged into videos, iPods, and MP3s. I remember watching a man. He was really with it. He was in a store, probably the manager, but he had his blueberry on his pocket. He had his phone plugged into his ear, and he was talking to people, and he was talking on the phone to other people, and I know he felt plugged in. But he was plugged into a digital cyber world. It wasn't plugged into other people. And there wasn't a plugging into their heart and their minds. Deuteronomy 6. The truth to me is that we are probably more disconnected than ever before to one another. More people today are alienated and feel a sense of being alone. And God didn't want this. This was never his intention. I think it's wonderful to leave an ethical will. It can be a beautiful reminder of those we loved. But I ask the question today, why wait until then? Why wait until we're dead to say these things to one another, to teach our lessons, to share our lives and our hearts and the meaning that we have in our lives? Why wait? We need to write these things of our experience in our lives as we live. Here's what God says in Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. Don't wait and have somebody else read your will, your ethical will. But live it now and speak it now. That's my point today. We're to give our children and grandchildren ethical wills in our lives. Talk about our innermost feelings to them now. How do you feel? Do the children know how the parents feel? Do they know what they experienced? I'll never forget, I and my mother had an estranged relationship for years until I was about 25 and my car was stolen and she called me and told me about it. And she said something to me. She said, "You know what? I love you, even though I always don't love what you do." And I just reeled for 2 weeks. And I went down, got leave, went down and talked to her, and I said something. "What was it like for you, Mom? What was it like for you when you were my age?" And the things she told me opened my eyes. I understood her like probably nobody had understood her for decades. You know, she had a tough life. I could understand why life was the way it was. I could understand her, and I'll be forever grateful for her talking with me openly like that. But you know, we need to do this, share the lessons we've learned and are learning in our lives as we learn them. I've seen this so many times. We think we're teaching our children. We tell them to go out and we tell them to clean the garage. We tell them to pull the weeds. We tell them to do the lawn work. We tell them to take out the trash. We'll show them how to do it, and then we leave them alone to do it. But I don't believe that's what God wants us to do. You see how it says here that you do it as you're going in and out and when you're doing all these things? You see, that's the time when there isn't pressure. I remember I tried to sit down with my kids because the church said once we should give Bible studies to our kids, and I'm talking to them, I'm lecturing them, and their eyes are glazing over. You know, and I realized, you see, that that's not when they're listening. But they are listening when you are talking to your wife. They're listening when you're talking to other people at church. They're listening when you're working together, when you're doing things, and you're not just looking face to face. Then that's when they'll talk. That's when they'll open up. And that's when you can open up. And that's when you can talk. And you can give them a living, ethical will. And it's so valuable. It's so valuable. You can show them principles, teach them principles about neatness, about quality, about doing a thorough job. And we show them our love in this way from our personal experiences, and we give them part of our lives. We connect with them in the projects and in the work that we're doing, and we leave them an ethical will in our lives. And this stays with them the longest. And in fact, this is one of the greatest issues in the Church of God. That the church children, you know, don't come back into the church. Why? It's because of the example of the parents that raised them. That's the reason. It's not because the doctrine isn't right or perfect or they believe some differently. They'll make up an excuse to believe differently because they don't want to, because they don't feel connected to the parents. So we tell them things. We tell them what they should do and give them our advice, but we don't live our values to them. Colossians 3. Colossians 3. For this reason, the Apostle Paul writes this, Colossians 3 and verse 17. "Whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God and the Father by him." So everything we do, we're supposed to do it to God. But how do we do that? What are you talking about, Paul? What do you mean by that? How exactly is this supposed to work out in our lives? Well, it says, continuing on, "Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as is fit in the Lord. And husbands, love your wives. Be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. And fathers, don't provoke your children to anger, lest they become discouraged. And even servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men-pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God." And then he concludes, "And whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord, and not unto men." And so whatever age we find ourselves in, and whatever state of life we find ourselves in, it's what we do that really matters. It's what we're doing that counts. And as we live our lives, we're actually living an ethical will. Let's go to Mark 12. Let's pop over to Mark 12. There's some wonderful examples of individuals in the Bible who left, as it were, such a will, ethical will. Mark 12, and verse 41. Jesus was standing by the treasury here, and he was watching the people. And you know he could read minds, and he saw them throw in their pennies. They didn't throw in large amounts of money. They threw in a large collection of coins. And the coins were probably the smaller amount of coins. It wasn't that they were giving lots of their wealth away, but of their wealth, they threw in more coins. So anyway, in verse 41, and Jesus sat over against the treasury, and he beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And so Clark writes in his commentary that there were rabbinical laws about how much you could put in the treasury. And the fact was, the law was, you couldn't put in any less than two mites. So you see, this widow doesn't have very much money, you know, but she's not going to not give to God. She's going to give to God, but she's forced by these men to give it all. But she would rather give it all than not give something. And so she casts in her two mites. And then Jesus says by this, you see, she left an ethical will for us. He calls his disciples over. He says, I want you to see this. And then he shows them, and they watch what she does. And he says in verse 43, and he called unto him his disciples and said unto them, truly I say unto you, that this poor widow has cast in more than all they which has cast in to the treasury. They did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even her living. What a tremendous lesson for us today about our relationship with God and what's really important. And so this was an ethical will left. Now there's another case. Let's go to Luke 7. Luke 7. I want to bring out another one. Here Jesus leaves an example that is to be a memorial. And he left it to be indelibly written in our minds, in our experience. We're not to renege on our obligations to God, even if it means some sort of sacrifice. Now, here's another example in Luke 7, where someone is memorialized by him for us. He was invited, likely, to somebody's dinner. I mean, you can imagine how many people would want to have the teacher over. Thousands are following this guy. There's rumors about miracles of making food and doing all kinds of things, healing people and bringing them back from the dead, and these things are circulating all over. You can imagine how popular it would be to have him over, and they'd want to ask questions and so on. But he was invited to go to a certain man's name who was a Pharisee named Simon, and a woman came to him. She heard that he was there at this man's house, and she came to the house in verse 37 of chapter 7. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment. And she stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had bidden him, saw it, He spoke within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known what manner of woman this is that touches him, and she is a sinner. Jesus knew what he was thinking, and he says something which I believe is deeply profound for us. Verse 40 here. And Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, Master, say on. And Jesus said, there was a certain creditor which had two debtors, and one owed him 500 pence and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? And Simon answered and said, I suppose he to whom he had forgiven most. And he said unto him, you've judged rightly in this case. And he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, see this woman? I entered into your house. You gave me no water for my feet. And she's washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. I read a book called Strange Scriptures that perplexed the Western mind. And in that book, it talked about tears. And they said that what they would do in ancient Israel was this, that they would save their tears in a bottle because they would cry over enormously important events, and they would actually put some of those tears in a bottle, and that they believed that in this case, this woman emptied the bottle. This was the most precious thing a person could have, and she emptied the bottle on his feet, not just the tears that fell from her eyes that moment. You gave me no kisses, but this woman, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet, my head with oil you didn't anoint, but this woman has anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she has loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. And he said unto the woman, your sins are forgiven. Man, that is amazing. Now, there's a parallel account in Matthew, and I'm just going to read what he says. Truly, I say unto you, wherever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also be that this woman has done, to be told for a memorial of her, an ethical will. It's left here for you and I to read, to see what really matters. It's how much we love him, how much we do because of our love for him, how much we do for others, and how we love one another. That's the thing that is going to count when it comes to the forgiveness of our sins. Love covers, as it says. And so she left an enormous will for us to read. But I remind you of this. There's many who left ethical wills. Let's look at Psalm 71, for example. Psalm 71. Here we're talking about David, King David. He knew what he was writing in these psalms. In verse 17 and 18, he says, O God, you've taught me from my youth, and hitherto I've declared your wondrous works. Now also, when I'm old and I'm gray-headed, before I die, forsake me not until I've shown your strength unto this generation and the power to everyone that is to come. He knew he wrote the Psalms as love letters to God. And he knew he wrote them not just for this generation, but he wrote them for the generations that were to follow. It was his ethical will. Hebrews 11. Here we have the heroes of faith, and it's mentioned, many are mentioned. But there's an interesting statement, I don't know if you ever picked up on it, in chapter 4. They all left their testimony. They all left their example for us who would come along later. In verse 4, it says, by faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it, he being yet dead, yet speaks. Do you get it? You see what I'm saying? He is still speaking to us. His offering is telling us a lesson about the love of God and what to give. And he is like the widow that gave of his physical things to God. 2 Peter 1. 2 Peter 1. You remember the Paul wrote and he said he knew he was going to depart and then he gave advice. So did Peter. So did Peter do that, 2 Peter. They wrote knowing they were going to die. What would you do if you knew you were going to die? What would you want to pass on? What would you say? And here's Peter, 2 Peter. 2 Peter 1 and verse 5. He says, besides this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and then to brotherly kindness charity. For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he that lacks these things is blind and can't see far off, and has forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. So give diligence to make your calling and your election sure. But you understand, I'm going to die. And I now want to pass on to you, here are the steps to spiritual growth. Here's how it works. I've learned this over a lifetime, and I now know I'm going to depart, and I want to give it to you. These are like invaluable words if we'll follow them, if we'll recognize them as how important they are. So I want to remind us this. Christ died for us. And in so doing, he left a will and testament. Most people don't think about this when they read the Bible, but the Old Covenant was not a testament. We call it an Old Testament, and I think sometimes we do this because it's a testimony, but it is not a testament. It is a covenant that was made. The New Testament is a will and a testament. And so, again, back in Matthew 26, Jesus says something of enormous importance, and we need to think about this as we near the Passover time. Matthew 26 and verse 26 is so vital. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat. This is my body. Then he took the cup and he gave thanks and gave it to them saying, drink all of it. For this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remissions of sins. And then over in Hebrews 9, it says this, verse 14. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And for this cause, he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might be received, they might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. For where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of a testator. For a testament is of force after men are dead. Otherwise, it's of no strength at all while the testator lives. Whereupon, neither the first testament was dedicated without blood. And so it is that we are part of a will. You and I are part of Christ's last will and testament. And it includes an enormous, I mean absolutely mind-blowing, if you will, phenomenal inheritance that is waiting in heaven for us. You and I will one day be rulers over cities. And some of you might be rulers over nations. And all the wealth of those nations will be brought to you and given to you. And eventually, we'll inherit the New Jerusalem. And there will be golden walls, golden streets. Yes, enormous pearls that are on the gates entering the city. The foundations made of precious stones of a building the size, imagine the foundation of a building the size that would go from Los Angeles to Dallas, Texas, and up into Canada. That's quite a stone. Beautiful, precious, and wonderful things we're going to inherit. But in order to inherit these things, we must overcome the pulls of Satan the devil. We must overcome the glitter and pull on us from this world and its advertising industry. And we must overcome our own human nature. And we've got to do this so that we will not waste that inheritance, we won't abuse that inheritance, we won't misuse it, but we will use it in the way that Jesus Christ would use it. And so we are now here to learn to imitate him. And this book is an ethical will showing us the lives of all those who went before us, who succeeded and who failed. And I remember a book by Larry Crabb that he wrote. He's a famous psychologist who's also a Bible reader. And he said this. He said, every single relational issue in life is found in this book in its history, its laws, or what its history and its laws imply. You can find the answer to every human problem in this book. Why? Because it's God's ethical will to us. That's why. It's a wonderful thing he left us. So we're to follow Christ's example and imitate him. You know, in today's world, we still have our mind on the physical so much. I remember I was in another group one time, and we were having a meeting, and there was a discussion about an individual who had left the group. And he left the group, and one of the other men who was a minister actually said this to me, "Oh, well, just another jewel in my crown." What was he thinking? Is it just about the jewels? Is it about how much more we're going to get? You understand, missing the point completely. Missing the point completely. And so such thinking shows that so many of us can be still focused on the physical, and the physical in life. And so we can leave our money to our children and posterity, and sometimes it may even cause grief and fighting among them. You know, there's one man who thought he knew the answer. He was so tight, when he died, he still had the first dollar he'd ever made. He didn't trust anyone, so he would take his money and put it in the mattress. Even his wife didn't know about it. However, in time, he unfortunately contracted a very serious disease, and he knew he was going to die. So he went ahead and he confessed to his wife where he had put this money. But he made her promise before he died that she would put all of that money in his casket because he wanted to have a good start in the next life. So she went and made the arrangements for the funeral and then finally went that day to the funeral, and she fulfilled that request of her husband, and she opened the casket for the last time and inserted a check for the money that she had deposited in the bank. But how much money we have doesn't matter. What kind of car we drive doesn't matter. And whoever dies with the most toys dies. They die. That's it. Okay. For this reason, the Savior leaves us an ethical will telling us this. Don't lay up for yourselves treasure on earth where moth and rust corrupts and thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust can corrupt and where thieves can't break in and steal. And he says to do this because where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. So today I ask you, okay, how do you store your treasure in heaven? I know a lot of times it's equated to giving offerings to church, but I'm asking you to give this more thought. You know, we are rewarded according to our works. And so realize we've been given this book, its lessons, the people who live their lives with their hopes and dreams in it, and their failures too, as an ethical will to us so that we can live and learn from their example. And it's given to the church to proclaim, to continue that purpose of its intention. And Christ said, I work and my Father works. And so we're to take this ethical will, I believe, deeply seriously. And now we're in a spiritual battle. And the battle is a battle for our mind. And we're to cast down every imagination and bring every thought in the captivity of Jesus Christ. And we're to strive to imitate him and to model him. And so from righteous Abel to the apostles, all of the children of God have made sacrifices. Because that's the theme of this book, isn't it? From Abel to the apostles, the theme is sacrifice. You know, in baseball, a batter will often bunt or intentionally hit a pop fly to center field. And he does this so that the runner who's already on base can score a point or get to the next plate. And when a player does this, it goes down in the record book as a sacrifice. That's what they call it, a sacrifice. Because that person thought it was more productive to give up his chance to run the bases in order to help the team have a better chance to win. Jesus Christ was our example. And he left his ethical will for us to view and to live by. And his life was a life of enormous sacrifice. And he did it in order to bring many sons and daughters into glory. So let's follow his example of sacrifice in our lives for others. And let's show our love, and let's show our appreciation for one another. And let's read this ethical will. Don't leave it on the shelf, just gathering dust, but read it in awe and read it with understanding. And let's follow its teachings to guide us to the right use of our future inheritance.